So I'll talk about R symmetry and non-perturbative QFT. So of course, it's a very broad subject matter, but the focus of the talk will be very specific. So I'll just talk about two sets of operators that are well-defined in these theories. One is the R current, the multiplet for the R current that any R symmetric theory has. And the second operator, or set of operators, is a long scalar multiplet that's related to this R current multiplet by a conservation equation in superspace, which I'll discuss briefly. And I'll use these two multiplets of operators to try to say a lot about the physics of theories that have R symmetry. So it's based on a series of three papers. I won't have much to say about the first one. This is a paper with Ignatius Antoniadis. It concerns the question of scale versus conformal invariance in these kinds of theories. I'll have some sort of indirect comments about it as we go along, but I'll focus mostly on these last two papers, a paper with Steve Abel and Zohar Komargotsky, and then a paper that I wrote on my own in September. Okay, so let me give you an overview of what I'll talk about. So I'll start with some generalities about the renormalization group flow with and without supersymmetry. And then I'll immediately sort of focus to cases with supersymmetry, and in particular cases that have an R symmetry preserved throughout the RG flow. So those are not the most general set of supersymmetric theories, but they're quite general. So for example, super QCD is an example of such a theory. It has an R symmetry, which is good even away from the UV and the IR fixed points. And within this class of theories, I'll sort of split my talk up into two pieces, okay? The first piece will have to do with mapping certain operators in these kinds of theories from the UV to the IR. So given some short distance degrees of freedoms, quarks and gluons, and some operators built out of these guys, the question is what do they map to in terms of the emergent infrared degrees of freedom? So I'll tell you about that. I mean, I'll go over the lore about conserved currents, simple things to map like conserved currents, elements of the chiral ring. And then I'll talk about mapping some more complicated operators, these long multiplets, in particular this U multiplet that I mentioned earlier, this long scalar multiplet that's related to the R current multiplet by a conservation equation. And so throughout, I'll emphasize the role of R symmetry, the R current multiplet. I'll give you some examples to show you that I'm not completely crazy what I'm talking about. So I'll talk about super QCD, the Kutasov theory, and the adjoint super QCD theory. And then in the last half of the talk, so I'll also discuss some applications of this formalism. And in the last part of the talk, I'll focus on correlation functions of certain of these operators and use these correlation functions to say something about the infrared phases of some of these gauge theories. So in particular, these correlation functions won't be related to the usual correlation functions that you use to get quantities of physical interest. So there are some correlation functions, for example, which determine the A and C coefficients in the deep IR. The correlation functions that I'll talk about are some genuinely new ones that contain additional information beyond A and C, and contain some additional information sort of beyond the A theorem. And so I'll discuss constraints using these correlation functions on the IR phase. In particular, I'll address the question of whether you can discriminate between a theory that interacts in the infrared or is free. Okay, so this is an old question in these kinds of theories. So under some rather general assumptions, so we'll be interested in UV complete quantum field theory. So under some rather general assumptions, these quantum field theories can be understood as interpolations between two scale invariant limits, one that describes the short distance physics and one that describes the long distance physics. The precise nature of the scale invariant limits in the four dimensions is not completely understood. So in all known examples, they're conformal fixed points. Recently, it's been a subject of a lot of research, whether you can have fixed points which are scale invariant but non-conformal. You've heard about this from Andy and from Jeff, but I'll assume mostly throughout this talk that the flows that we talk about will be between two conformal field theories. And so given some well-defined operators in this class of theories and some correlation functions of these operators in the UV, the question is, can we say something about the corresponding objects in the IR? And a related question in this class of theories is to understand what the emergent symmetries are of the IR fixed points. And in general, you expect a lot of new internal and space-time symmetries as you go to the IR. And the question is, what are they? And how do we get a handle on them? So you know, you have a picture where you have a lot of irrelevant operators along the flow that decay away, right? I mean, they get washed out as you go to long distances. These irrelevant operators violate some internal symmetries that then only appear in the long distance limit. So these are new internal symmetries. And also they violate some other symmetries. Typically they violate conformality, scale invariance. And so even though the question of which new internal symmetries appear in the long distance limit is sort of very model dependent, it depends on your theory, I'll try to convince you that there are some very interesting model independent statements that you can make even about the internal symmetries that emerge in the long distance theory. And so the question is, how do we get a handle on them? And of course, yeah.
For the internal symmetry, you're talking about your Yes. Global symmetry.
That's right. Yeah.
So for internal symmetries, that's fine. But for space-time symmetries, do you think about things like if you have a lattice to the UV, you'll get
Yeah. So I won't assume anything about a lattice or a regulator.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. As an analogy.
You could. So I mean, what I have in mind about the space-time symmetries are the question of, you know, so what do the symmetries get enhanced to? Do they get enhanced to the scale, just the Poincaré plus scale, or Poincaré plus scale plus, you know, the full conformal group? So those are generally the symmetries that the space-time symmetries you expect to emerge in the theory. Although I won't have a whole lot to say about the scale versus conformal question. So in general, non-perturbative dynamics along the RG flow make these questions hard to answer. So, yeah, but what we'll do is we'll specialize the four-dimensional R-symmetric theories, and as we'll see, supersymmetry and the particular R-symmetry will give us some strong handles to use to answer these questions in some controlled settings. So the first half of the talk is literally concerned with this question here. So given some well-defined operator, by which I mean local and gauge invariant in the UV, what is the corresponding guy in terms in the IR? So there are some easy operators to map. Yeah, so it's a well-defined question because you pick some operator. So we'll discuss currents. So I'll specialize throughout this talk
so
the currents.
I'll
talk about a particular current. So the operator that I'm talking about will be a current in this talk. So you can start in the UV with some operator that's well-defined. In other words, local and gauge invariant.
Yeah.
This is some operator, and then you know this is deep in the UV, far from way above all the scales in the theory. So where the theory is conformal, and you can ask what happens as you follow the RG flow into the IR. In general, following such an operator to the IR is very difficult because you have mixing and stuff. But there are certain operators that you can follow in supersymmetric theories. So I'll discuss those. Yeah, that you understand how the RG flow works. So it'll be quite amazing that part of the talk will be mapping some currents that are actually anomalous. So it'll be quite bizarre that you can actually do this. But I'll show you why this works in R-symmetric theories. So there are some easy operators to map. These include short multiplets. So remember, I'm specializing to supersymmetry here. So these are members of the chiral ring and conserved currents. These are just the standard things that you do, for example, in Seiberg duality, right? In the free magnetic phase, you have some electric QCD and super QCD in the UV in terms of some electric squarks. In the IR, you have some magnetic squarks and magnetic mesons. And you map elements of the chiral ring and you map conserved currents, right? Because the Tuft anomaly matching, basically mapping the conserved currents, amounts to doing the Tuft anomaly matching, which is one of these standard tests of Seiberg duality. But harder operators to map are operators that are long multiplets, so not annihilated by supercharges or combinations of supercharges. But the key to this talk, at least the first half, will be that sometimes we can embed these long multiplets inside short multiplets of higher spin and use these large multiplets to gain some traction. So at a very basic level, in asymptotically free theories, the quantities of interest to me in this talk will be UV bilinears of this form. So if I imagine these are some free fields in the UV, some chiral superfields with flavor indices I and J, I'll consider bilinears built out of phi dagger I, phi J, with some general matrices in flavor space, okay? And maybe some appropriate factors of the gauge field to make it gauge invariant. And for generic matrices C and C tilde, this will define a long multiplet, by which I mean, well, it's non-chiral, manifestly, and also it's not annihilated by D bar squared in general, because for generic combinations of C and C tilde, you'll pick up, you know, some gauge anomaly, plus possibly some violation from superpotential terms. If this quantity vanished, so if D bar squared acting on this quantity vanished, then this superfield, this would be the lowest component of a superfield that would contain a conserved current in its theta-theta bar component. But when there's something non-zero on the right-hand side, like a gauge anomaly, it contains some current that's not conserved, either by anomaly or by violation from a superpotential.
So those are all these things that's sitting in the Kähler potential?
If you like, yeah. Yeah, these are related to the Kähler. I mean, the Kähler potential is a type of operator like this. Yeah. So the question is, can we map such an operator to the infrared? So to do this, what we need is we need a short multiplet in which to embed it. So in an R-symmetric theory, there's a natural candidate. That's the R-symmetry current superfield. It's a primary field in the UV, so it's a field that can't be written as the supercharged variation of a well-defined lower dimensional field. So you can use this field, as I'll show you in a second, to embed this long multiplet and follow it along the RG flow. So to understand how the R-symmetry current helps, it's useful to recall the supersymmetry algebra. So the R current, the R-symmetry, as you know, is an automorphism of the supersymmetry algebra. So it acts on Q, and it gives you back Q times some uninteresting constant. And Q acting on Q bar gives you the momentum. Now, this R current, therefore, transforms into multiplet with the corresponding currents of these guys transforming the same multiplet. And this R current in particular transforms into multiple with the supercurrent and the stress tensor. So of course there's an ambiguity when you talk about current algebra because there are Schwinger terms and other things that don't manifest themselves in the charge algebra. But one particularly nice way to fix these terms is to use the equation in three. So I write an R current superfield where I've traded the mu index for the R current for two spinner indices, alpha and alpha dot. And the lowest component of this operator is of this operator multiplied is just the R current. And d bar alpha dot is the anti-chiral superspace derivative. Acting on it gives you chi alpha, where chi alpha is, again, something chiral that satisfies a Bianchi identity, so it's some kind of field strength, if you like. And when this chi alpha is equal to zero, this is the well-known superconformal R current multiplet. So it's the R current, it's the multiplet for the R current that transforms in the same multiplet as the traceless stress tensor and supercurrent. But even more generally, even away from the conformal fixed point, and even at a conformal fixed point, you have R currents which are not the superconformal ones. And in that case, you pick up this anomaly, chi alpha. Okay. Now there's an ambiguity. In writing this equation. And this ambiguity may seem academic at first, but it'll be particularly important in the second part of the talk. But this equation has an ambiguity under which you can deform the R current by a non-R current. So a non-R current sits in a superfield J, which is scalar, which is annihilated by d bar squared J. And acting with the commutator of d alpha and d bar alpha dot on J gives you the current, gives you the theta theta bar component of this multiple, which is just the non-R current. So it's a trivial statement that if you have a good R symmetry of the theory, some R symmetry which is non-anomalous, conserved throughout the flow, and you have some flavor symmetry which is also good, then adding the two gives you just another R symmetry, which is also good. And so this equation is deformed by adding on this side this operator here. And chi alpha is deformed basically by the field strength of the corresponding superfield that embeds the current, the non-R current J. Okay? So this transformation affects the super, it generally changes the R current because it changes the assignment of the R charges. But it only affects the supercurrent and the stress tensor through improvement terms. So in terms that are still conserved, that are conserved themselves and don't contribute to the corresponding charges. So for the theories that we'll consider, chi alpha has a very special form. It has the form d bar squared d alpha of u for a well-defined u. So again, for a local engaged invariant u. So that doesn't generally, yeah.
Can you go back
yeah.
to the slide?
Yep.
So isn't that sort of chi alpha that you just chose, isn't that sort of like pure gauge?
Yeah, so I'll explain this. So that's a good question. So I claim, first of all, that this u is so not all chi alpha can be written this way. So for example, when you have a gauge field, so you're thinking of chi alpha, let's say, as a gauge field, super field, then that u is not really, it's not gauge invariant, right? I mean, u is just the gauge field. So I'm restricting. So in particular, you could ask how does, so, right? So that's a chi alpha. So chi alpha in particular, so you could have a chi alpha, say, where the gauge field appears. If you turn on, say, a field-independent Fi term, then the corresponding conformal anomaly will just be chi, you know, the Fi term times the gauge superfield V acted on by d bar squared d alpha. But that V, that operator V, will not be well defined because it won't be gauge invariant. So the theories that I'll discuss are ones that have well defined operators U. So basically what that means is that there are theories that don't have field independent Fi terms, and there are theories that don't include sigma models that have non-trivial target space topology, basically where the period of the Kähler form is non-trivial on some cycles. So they will never be non-trivial, and so U will be globally well-defined, and it'll be gauge invariant in the theories that I discuss. Okay, so I'll restrict myself. So this is a subset of the R-symmetric theories. Of course, you can have, say, there's nothing wrong at the level of global field theory, right, with having global supersymmetry, with having an Fi term, you know, free U1 theory with an Fi term. That's R-symmetric, but it's a theory that doesn't have a well-defined U. So the fact that U will be well-defined will be crucial because we'll consider correlation functions of these objects and we'll want to read off certain coefficients of these correlation functions, so we'll want U to be a well-defined operator. So you can solve this equation, the equation d bar alpha dot r alpha dot equals chi alpha for an asymptotically free theory. It's very trivial. So in terms of the UV, the free UV fields phi, it's just given by some, you know, some fermions plus some bosons and fermions weighted by some R charge Ri, which in general is different from the superconformal one. So in the free superconformal theory, all the chiral multiples get assigned R charge 2/3. More generally, you can have an R symmetry which assigns R charges different from 2/3. And the corresponding U operator that you get by solving this equation up here then looks like this. It's a sum over the phi bar i's, phi i's, times some difference in the R charge between the the UV R current that you pick and the superconformal one. Okay? So if I pick the superconformal R charge, then U would vanish. Otherwise, if I pick a different R symmetry, then U is non-vanishing. More generally, even when you don't have an asymptotically free theory, so I'll also talk about flows from interacting UV fixed points, the vector component of this multiplet just parameterizes the difference between the R symmetry that you select and the superconformal one in the UV. Okay? And this mapping U is fixed up to deformations by holomorphic plus anti-holomorphic objects. And we'll see later that even if you fix these guys to vanish in the UV, they can appear in the IR, but this won't really affect any of the statements that I'll make. Okay, so the basic idea is going to be to use this R multiplet to follow this non-conserved U multiplet along the flow. So the assumption, again, will be that the UV and IR fixed points are superconformal field theories. So again, this is okay, it's not a closed question in general, and there's a lot of work on understanding whether this is generally true in four dimensions. But I'll assume that this is true, and I claim that this can be made rigorous in super QCD-like theories. So this is the result from the paper with Ignatios in February. And what I mean by super QCD-like theories are theories that start from a free fixed point in the UV, and you just turn on a gauge coupling, so you don't deform things by anything else. Yes?
Could you move back one slide?
Yeah.
So, so if phi is charged,
yes,
under some gauge group, U does not contain any, this is a singlet, right?
Yeah, U is a singlet. So you could contain, so if you like, if these guys transform under gauge fields, I've just suppressed factors of e to the v.
Oh, so
there could be e to the v.
Yeah.
Yeah, if these guys are non-singlets, then there would be compensating factors. Mm-hmm. So use a gauge singlet. Yeah, so again, so I'll assume that these guys are superconformal field theories. I claim that this can be made rigorous, as I said, in super QCD-like theories, which is a subset of theories that start from a free fixed point, and you turn on just a gauge coupling. So this will be some subset of the theories we're interested in, but it won't be the most general set. So at the infrared fixed point, what we know is we know what should happen to this R current multiplet R alpha alpha dot. So either this guy flows to the superconformal R current in the IR, or it flows to a multiplet that can be improved to the superconformal R current. So it flows either to something, so it has to flow to some R current of the IR theory. And in general, that IR limit of the R current, which I call RIR, differs from the superconformal one, which I call R tilde, by some non-trivial flavor symmetry. So this U operator in the IR, it just flows to something which measures the difference between the IR limit of the R current that's conserved throughout the flow and the superconformal one in the IR fixed point. So R tilde, R tilde IR means the superconformal R current at the IR fixed point. Mm-hmm. And RIR means the IR limit of the R symmetry that's preserved throughout the RG flow. This guy in particular is not conserved away from the IR fixed point, so it's conserved only in the limit where you separate operators. Exactly. Yeah.
And R is something that is defined broadly throughout.
Yeah. So this is something that's defined in the UV and that you follow along the flow to the IR. Now it may happen that this guy flows to this guy, in which case the IR superconformal R current is defined in the UV. So that's believed to be the case in super QCD in the conformal window. But more generally, that doesn't have to be the case. So this difference here is a non-R symmetry, which could be just an accidental symmetry of the IR fixed point. So it could be a symmetry that only acts at the IR fixed point, or it could be, you know, a combination of an IR symmetry that acts at the fixed point, plus an accidental symmetry plus a symmetry of the full theory. Okay? So we'll see an extreme version of this in super QCD in the free magnetic range, where this corresponding U consists of symmetries that are really only preserved in the long distance limit, that are accidental symmetries of the IR fixed point. Now, in the case that UIR equals zero, you can say a bit more using conformal perturbation theory. So if the approach is via a marginally irrelevant operator, then U corresponds to some current superfield J that's conserved at the fixed point, but that's not conserved away. So for example, if you have super QCD with NC equals 2 and NF equals 3, then this is a theory of mesons in the IR, and it's the approach to the IR fixed point is via a marginally irrelevant operator, W equals M cubed in the superpotential. And then U is just the operator M dagger M, which in the deep IR is conserved, but is violated by the superpotential away from it. And so this is what U is slightly away from the fixed point. Otherwise, what you have is that U goes as some operator O of dimension greater than 2 by unitarity. So in the case of a free magnetic phase, what we have is we have that U in the IR is some operator built out of the emergent degrees of freedom. So it looks a lot like this U in the UV, which was built in terms of the short distance phis, big phis, And then similarly in the IR, you have a guy which is built in terms of the emergent little phis. And these guys, again, this UIR is given by the difference between RI, the R current that you've studied throughout the flow, and the difference of, and the superconformal R current in the IR, which is again 2/3 if the theory is free. But more generally, you can have U and the IR just given by this expression here, even when you don't have a free fixed point in the IR. So the first example, just to get our bearings, is super QCD in the free magnetic range. So this is SUNC with NF greater than NC plus 1 and less than or equal to 3NC over 2. So this is a flow between Gaussian fixed points. And the UV theory is very simple. It's just the, you know, theory of fundamentals and anti-fundamentals.
Q, yeah.
Free theories. Yeah, it's a fancy way of saying free. So Q and Q tilde are fundamentals and anti-fundamentals of SUNC. And then you have this global symmetry group, which is good throughout the flow. So there's a chiral SUNF left times SUNF right, under which these guys transform as fundamentals and anti-fundamentals. There's a U and R symmetry that's non-anomalous, that's preserved throughout the flow of the gauge coupling, under which these guys have this R charge here. And there's a baryon U1, under which these guys transform with opposite phases. So these are conserved currents. So some bilinears that we can write in the UV are composites of these Q and Q dagger fields with flavor indices I and J. And so the question is, what do these map to in the infrared? So the infrared theory has been solved thanks to Seiberg. So it consists of a dual gauge group, SUNF minus NC, with some quarks, dual quarks Q and Q tilde, and some magnetic mesons M, which transform under the same symmetries of the UV theory in the way I've listed here. So with, in general, different charge assignments. And some objects are trivial to map. So for example, the baryon, the superfield that contains the baryon current, QQ dagger minus Q tilde dagger, gets mapped to something that acts only on the magnetic quarks with some coefficient that depends on NC and NF. It's just fixed by matching chiral primaries, by matching baryons between the UV and the IR. So this is the, one of the standard tests of Seiberg duality. But a more non-trivial operator to map is the axial current. So if you just switch the minus sign to a plus sign, you get an operator which is much more non-trivial because it's non-conserved. In particular, d bar squared acting on it gives you some gauge anomaly. And so the question is, can we say what this guy is in terms of the IR degrees of freedom? So the claim is yes, and we can follow it using the R multiplet. So what you can do is you can use the R charge assignments in the electric table. So these R charge assignments here. You can use the simple formula that I've given you here in the UV to write then the operator U in the UV. And then in the IR, you can use the magnetic charge R charge assignments. And you can write the corresponding operator in terms of the magnetic degrees of freedom, the magnetic quarks and the magnetic mesons. And you see in general, this is a much more complicated operator that acts on, well, it mixes with a current that also acts on the mesons, so not just the baryons. And so in particular, you have this mapping here, that this QQ dagger plus Q tilde dagger flows to this non-trivial combination here. And acting with D bar squared on the left and the right-hand sides gives you a mapping between the electric and magnetic field strengths, which is weighted by some coefficient, which is negative in the free magnetic phase. It differs from what you typically see in the literature. So usually in the literature, you see that W squared electric goes to minus W squared magnetic. But actually, that statement is not very meaningful in the theory where you don't add masses, because W squared is trivial. So that's a statement in the chiral ring. And W squared is trivial in the chiral ring because it's D bar squared of something. So the statement that W squared electric goes to minus W squared magnetic in this theory here without mass terms turned on is just the statement that 0 equals 0. But this statement here is more meaningful because this follows from the normalization that you get by following the supercurrent multiplet. So one application of this, which I won't have tons of time to get into, is soft supersymmetry breaking in strongly coupled theories. So this is in the paper with Steven Zohar, but what you can do is you can imagine deforming the UV Lagrangian by adding the bottom component of this U multiplet and adding the bottom component of this W squared electric multiplet. So these are soft terms for squarks and gauginos. And then you can follow these in some probe approximation where you sort of imagine that these soft terms are small and don't back react on the strong supersymmetric dynamics. And then to linear order, you can map what these guys correspond to in the IR just using the supersymmetric mappings. And you can make contact with some results, some old results from the 90s by Arkani Hamid, Rotazzi, Ludi, and Rotazzi. They did some similar things from a slightly different perspective. Okay, so the second example is the deformed moduli space. So each of these examples will illustrate some slight subtlety of this whole procedure. So this case is NF equals NC super QCD with NC bigger than 2. So in the IR, the theory is consists of mesons and baryons, satisfying moduli space constraint, det M minus BB tilde equals lambda to the 2NC, where lambda is the dynamical scale. So this is Seiberg's famous relation. And because of this, some of the short distance symmetries of the theory have to be spontaneously broken. So some of these guys will have to get VEVs. So we'll find that there are some ambiguities in falling U. They're not lethal. They're not very important. But in some vacua, you won't have enough broken, non-linearly realized symmetry to fix U. In others, we will. I won't discuss the cases where there's not enough symmetry to follow the operator U. I'll only discuss the cases where there is. But what you can do is you can consider first the following vacuum. So you can consider a vacuum on the baryonic branch where the mesons have zero VeV, and the baryons B and B tilde have equal VeVs. And in this vacuum, the global symmetry of the theory is broken, as I've written here. So the chiral symmetry is left untouched because the mesons don't have a VeV, whereas the baryon symmetry is broken because the baryons acquire a VeV. So this symmetry is Higgs. Well, it's not Higgs, but it's broken. And the U and R symmetry is left untouched because this equation here, since the R symmetry is not anomalous, it implies that the mesons and the baryons have zero R charge.
What is the actual ground state
of the system? It's a free theory, which of mesons and baryons, basically. Well, there's a whole moduli space of VeVs. So this is one particular nice choice of VeVs that simplifies the analysis. But there's a whole module. It's all the solutions to this equation here. They can all be chosen. But in all cases, it's a free theory, which consists of some different numbers of mesons and baryons. So you can use the previous techniques I've described, this mapping of the R charges, to fix U in the following way. So delta M are just the mesons. Delta B is the superfield that contains the Goldstone boson for the breaking of the baryon symmetry, plus its complex partner, plus its fermionic partner. So it's a superfield, chiral superfield. And this is what you get, but this can't be the whole story, right? Because this guy here is not invariant under the non-linearly realized baryon symmetry. So in the IR, the baryon symmetry acts by shifting the superfield B because the Goldstone field shifts. So it shifts by some imaginary constant, so this U is not invariant. But the U that you started with in the UV was invariant, right? Because it was something built out of the quarks and gluons. So whatever you have in the IR, this U has to be invariant under the corresponding non-linearly realized symmetry. But it's pretty easy to fix things up. So you can just write, so you can write down a term 1/2 delta B plus delta B dagger squared. You see that the cross terms exactly reproduce this guy here. But there are also some holomorphic plus anti-holomorphic terms, some delta B squared plus delta B dagger squared. These terms are not very important, except that they fix the transformation properties of U. Okay, so now this U is invariant under the non-linearly realized baryon symmetry. So the third example, which illustrates something interesting, is the Kutásov theory. So this is a theory which is similar to super QCD, except it has an adjoint of the SUNC. And there's a non-trivial superpotential for this adjoint. So it's a trace x to the k plus 1, where k is some integer. And at least for NF and C and k in this regime here, this deformation here for k greater than or equal to 2 is called dangerously irrelevant, because it starts out as irrelevant near the UV fixed point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Did you end up calculating it that way, or did you just know?
Yeah. That's the way. Yeah. That's the way it's calculated. That's exactly the way it's calculated. Yeah. Yeah. R and the IR is again a free RIR, and then the R tilde IR, the superconformal guys. So this is the electric theory. So this deformation here is called dangerously irrelevant. So what that means is that near the UV fixed point, it's irrelevant. But for this range of parameters, it becomes relevant as you flow along the RG flow. In particular, it drives the theory to a new fixed point. So this has been described by Kutásov and collaborators. So it consists of an SUK and F minus NC gauge theory with superfield with dual squarks Q and Q tilde, dual adjoints Y, and mesons MJ, which are built out of linear combinations, well, built out of operators that contain QQ tilde times X to some power. Okay. Now, and some non-trivial superpotential. Unfortunately, some of the symmetries have been cut off, but whatever. The main point of interest is that the UV superpotential is special. It gives you two sources of non-conservation in the UV. So the non-conserved current sector is more complicated now, because one source of non-conservation is the gauge current, is the gauge coupling. The other is the superpotential. So in particular, there's a current Jx which is not preserved by the superpotential, but which is non-anomalous. And this guy Jx can't be followed by using an R current. It's not surprising, right? Because you only have one conserved current superfield R mu, but you'll have two sources of non-conservation. So this guy Jx can never be written in a supercurrent conservation equation that involves a well-defined R current. So using baryon matching, you can fix some of the coefficients here, but it can't be followed using the R multiple. But the other non-conserved guy, which in general is violated both by the superpotential and by the anomaly, can be followed. So this complicated guy U, which is also non-conserved, can be followed using the R current. So you find it's not very interesting, but you find UIR is this much more complicated guy, so you find this mapping here. So the final example is adjoint super QCD. So this case is a little bit trickier because it's not a flow anymore between free fixed points. So it's a flow between a free fixed point in the UV and an interacting one in the IR. So you have the same particle content as the Kutasov theory, but instead of having a superpotential for the adjoint, you have no superpotential at all. There's not much that's really understood about the infrared, but you can infer some things using A maximization and unitarity arguments. And in particular, as you lower the number of flavors, the number of QQ tilde pairs relative to the number of colors, the theory becomes more strongly coupled, and certain operators confine and decouple. So the picture is that as you lower NF, you get two sectors, one which is an interacting superconformal field theory, and another which is a decoupled sector of free fields. For example, for NF and NC, in large NF and NC, less than 3 plus root 7 to the minus 1, this meson QQ tilde decouples and becomes free. So you have some interacting sector plus some free theory of this meson. And you can ask whether you can map these operators.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right. I mean, so I would claim that it's not a full description of the theory in the IR. What you
but
do have,
R.
How can you calculate what? The R current? So I'll tell you that in a second. So if you give me a second. The answer is that you can't if the question is and the related R current, the answer is that you can't write down in general the contributions from the interacting sector. So I'll show you in a second. So just hold that thought for a second. So if you want to map, let's say this operator QQ dagger plus Q tilde dagger, what you can do, so this is the question that Dita is asking, you can write down explicitly what the operator maps to in the free sector. So it maps to some combination of mesons with some R charges here. And this function from J equals 0 to this function P, which is a function of NF and NC, tells you how many mesons are free. You compute using unitarity arguments and A maximization. This has been done by Kutasov and others. And then there's a plus dot, 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 because in general, we don't know how to write down things and contributions from the interacting sector. So that's unsatisfactory. But as you'll see now, I'll go to, in the next half of the talk, I'll discuss correlation functions, which are less ambitious because you won't be mapping operators directly from the UV to the IR. You'll be considering the less ambitious thing of mapping certain correlation functions. And there you'll see that even for strongly coupled theories, even for interacting theories in the IR, you'll be able to fill in what the dot, dot, dot is. So you won't be able to map the operator itself, but you'll be able to use anomaly matching to actually do some more complicated computations. Okay? So that's the end of operator mappings. Now is maybe the more interesting part of the talk. So what we've seen is that the R current multiplet gives us a handle on a particular long spin zero multiplet U. So the question is what is this guy good for? We saw it was good for, deforming the theory non-supersymmetrically. But the question, it's related to some objects that have some global importance, the supercurrent and the stress tensor. And the question is, what kind of information does it encode? So you might imagine on a lark that it encodes something about the phase of the IR theory. Maybe it tells you something about whether the IR, the deep IR, is interacting or free. So I'll claim that there is strong evidence that suggests the answer to this question is yes, surprisingly. So to support this claim, what we'll consider is we'll consider certain correlation functions of this U operator. So we'll be able to make more explicit statements about this correlation function with less information, because instead of mapping this full operator U, we'll just try to consider certain sectors, certain Green's functions involving U. And so what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to say some things about strongly interacting theories, some more things than we could in the previous slides. But before we get there, one thing we have to do is we have to fix U. So you remember that there was an ambiguity. We could shift an R current by a flavor current and get another good R current, and get a corresponding U that was basically shifted by the non-R current superfield. And so the question is which U and which R mu we want to fix. So it's ambiguous, but there are several actual possibilities for how to do it. But one nice one, one sort of very general one that gives you a prescription that you can apply to a wide class of theories is the R current that's defined by, up to some caveats that I'll explain in a minute, by performing A maximization in the deformed UV theory. So what I mean is you start from some interacting theory or free theory in the UV, whatever, it can be either. You turn on some relevant or marginally relevant deformation, and that deformation preserves some R symmetry. I'll assume that it preserves some R symmetry. and then you perform A maximization on that theory, that'll give you some R current, which descends from this UV fixed point, and I'll call this R current R visible. And the corresponding conserved current at the UV fixed point U, I'll call U visible. So the operators that I'll be interested in following, the two-point functions I'll be interested in discussing, are the two-point functions of the vector operator inside this current, inside this multiple U visible, U mu visible. So you can imagine, first of all, deleting the IR. So this would be a two-point function in the UV of a conserved current. So its index structure is fixed by current conservation. The only thing that's left unfixed is some overall coefficient, which I call tau UV. And then there's a corresponding guy in the IR, U mu IR visible with U mu IR visible. And this guy gives you a corresponding tau IR multiplied by the same tensor structure. Now, it's immediately clear so that in theories without accidental symmetries, so without symmetries that just emerge at the infrared fixed point, that tau in the UV is bigger than tau in the IR. And the reason is just, yeah.
How do you know this quality is conserved?
It has to be because this current, it measures the difference between the R current that's preserved throughout the RG flow and the superconformal one in the IR and UV fixed point. So these guys differ by conserved current.
Only in the IR.
And the deep UV, the UV fixed point. So you have some UV fixed point. No, but in the UV, remember that U in the UV is computed by taking the difference of R in the UV and the superconformal R current in the UV. There are two superconformal R currents, right? There's one. So there's one guy. Yes. So there are three currents. There are three currents here. So one is the superconformal guy in the UV. One is the superconformal guy in the IR. These guys are not related in any meaningful way. So these are two different guys. And the third guy in my class of theories is the guy that's sort of defined everywhere else, you know, in the bulk of the theory plus at the fixed points, which is R, you know, R. And it has a limit, you know. It goes from RUV. R I R.
But in your definition of U.
So U in the UV, if you remember, is the difference between R tilde UV and R UV. U in the IR is the difference between R tilde IR and R IR. That's what U is.
Right. So
it's conserved in the deep UV at the UV fixed point and conserved at the IR fixed point.
Okay. And that's all you need?
Yes. To fix this tensor structure, that's all you need. These coefficients are different.
You're not going to make claims on the behavior of these throughout the flow. So
no, I'm not going to make any claims. So that's a good point. I won't make it. I will actually strenuously stay away from making any claims about the thing throughout the flow. I'm only going to be interested in what happens near the UV fixed point and near the IR fixed point. That's it. It's a well-defined operator throughout the flow, but
yeah,
whether it has nice properties as an interpolating function, that's a subject for another talk. I mean, that's a lot more complicated. Whether it has some nice properties as an interpolating function. But I will consider that. So these guys should be interpreted. So this two-point function should be interpreted as two sets of two-point functions, one which is defined here at this fixed point, and one which is defined at this fixed point with different coefficients tau. So tau in the UV. So in theories without accidental symmetries, it's trivial that these guys obey some inequality. So tau in the UV will be bigger than tau in the IR, and the reason is that in theories without accidental symmetries, this A maximization procedure. Up to some caveats, which I'll discuss in a second, fixes an R current, this R current R, which will flow to the IR superconformal guy. So U flows to zero, so tau in the IR is just zero. Okay? Now, tau in the UV will be something non-zero, and furthermore positive by unitarity. So something positive has to be bigger than something that's zero, so tau UV is bigger than tau IR in the class of theories without accidental symmetries. But the conjecture will be kind of bold and conjecture that tau in the UV is bigger than tau in the IR more generally, even in theories with accidental symmetries. Okay? So, and this rule will give some information that's not contained, as I'll describe in a second. It's not related to any of the information that's contained in the A theorem. So I'll give you some strong evidence in this talk. I won't give you a proof, but I'll give you some strong evidence in support of this conjecture. So if for a second you believe it, what it implies is it implies a UV bound on accidental symmetries, in particular on the mixing of accidental symmetries with the IR superconformal R current. And if it's true, as I'll tell you in a minute, this will resolve a longstanding problem in supersymmetric gauge theories, which is the IR phase of the Intralligator-Seiberg and Schenker theory. This is a phase that's not resolved using the A theorem. And another point is that tau UV is a quantity in the UV CFT. It's well defined. It's the coefficient of some two-point function of conserved currents, but it's not intrinsically defined in it. So it's not like A and C. A and C you also compute from some two-point function of currents from C you compute from the two-point function of stress tensors. And A you can compute from higher point functions. But this guy is not intrinsically defined in the UVCFT. It's defined once you have in mind the UVCFT plus a relevant deformation that preserves an R symmetry. But you know, that doesn't matter. I'll still try to convince you that this rule exists, tau UV is bigger than tau IR, and that it contains some interesting information. So you won't learn anything about irreversibility, the RG flow, or any of this stuff from here. That's something you learn about from the A theorem. But yeah. So how do I define tau U? So you start at the UV fixed point, and you find the UV superconformal R current. So you just use the procedure of interrogator and Wecht. So you pick some random R symmetry of the UV CFT. You consider adding to it an arbitrary linear combination of the non-R symmetry flavor currents of the UV fixed point with real coefficients Ti. And then you construct an anomaly functional, which involves the cubic anomaly of this trial R current with coefficients T cubed minus the linear anomaly of this trial R current. And what interrogator and Wecht instructed us to do is to maximize this anomaly functional. So you differentiate it with respect to the TIs, you demand that vanishes, and then you construct the second derivative, the matrix of second derivatives, TI, TJ, and you demand that it's negative definite. And this defines the solutions, the TI and TJ, then defines for you the superconformal R current out of this possibility, out of this family, this infinite family of R currents. So what I want to imagine doing next is to deform the theory by turning on an R symmetry preserving relevant deformation or an R symmetry preserving VEV. So now, in this case, only some subset of the UV flavor currents, JUV, are still conserved. So some of them are generally violated by this relevant deformation, or some of them give rise to charges that don't annihilate the vacuum. But there's some subset which is still conserved and which still give rise to charges that annihilate the vacuum. And so maximizing this anomaly function over this subset gives you a new R current, RUV, which with some new coefficients T hat, which are different from the superconformal ones. So this operator then descends from an R symmetry of the UV fixed point and has a corresponding U operator, which is fixed basically by the way that I've described on the board earlier in the talk. So sometimes this procedure is not sufficient to fix some of the mixings of the flavor symmetries with the visible R current. This can happen, for example, in the presence of massive particles, because massive particles don't contribute to anomalies, so currents, oh, wow, that really 5 minutes? Oh, God. So massive currents don't contribute to anomaly functionals, therefore, and so in such a case, we can fix the mixing of these currents with the U, with the visible R symmetry and the visible U multiplet by demanding this orthogonality condition. So in this case, we can compute so that defines for us a tau in the UV and the IR, and in a free theory, it's just a sum of square of charges. In an interacting theory, you can compute it using Tuft anomaly matching. So this is the key. This allows us to fill in the dot, dot, dot. So for example, in interacting theories, the IR fixed points of super QCD, you can use this anomaly, this well-known identity from superconformal field theory, to compute using the superconformal R current, the two-point function coefficient of these conserved currents, tau UV and tau IR. And sometimes you need more complicated generalizations of this statement in order to do the evaluation over free fields. So here in super QCD, you use this in Tuft anomaly matching to actually do the computation of the free theory, free parent UV theory. Sometimes you need more complicated expressions in order to do that, but I won't discuss those cases in the talk. Those are in my paper. So a simple sanity check to make sure that what I'm saying makes sense is to consider a free field phi and a superpotential m phi squared. Okay? So this fixes an R symmetry with R charge 1 for phi. And the corresponding U charge of phi is a half. So tau in the UV is a quarter. And since the theory is trivial in the IR, it's massive. So tau in the UV is a quarter, which is bigger than zero. You can similarly construct a theory with two fields, phi 1 and phi 2, which preserves a flavor symmetry. Then you have to use this orthogonality condition I described before, but it doesn't matter. Again, you find that tau UV is bigger than tau IR. So now, the more interesting example is super QCD. So in super QCD, the R symmetry of Q and Q tilde is fixed to be the same, and the U charges are fixed to be the same. There's some function of NF and NC. So I'll consider the limit NF less than 3 NC so we can start from a free UV theory. And I'll start with NF equals NC and work our way up. And all the subtleties I discussed so far will appear. So in the deformed modulus case for NF equals NC, it's easy to compute tau in the UV. It's a free field computation. It's just 2 NC squared. In the IR, you have a deformed moduli space using this constraint here, and you have in particular less than nc squared plus 2 mesons, m and baryons, b, b tilde. Again, you can compute the R charge of these guys and the corresponding U charges. They contribute, they have all have U charge minus 1. Therefore, they contribute charge plus 1 to tau IR. And so since tau IR is less than nc squared plus 2, and this is less than 2nc squared for nc greater than or equal to 2, which is what you need in order to have the deformed moduli space, you need non-abelian dynamics, tau UV is bigger than tau IR in this case. Next, you can go to the case of nf equals nc plus 1. In that case, you can again compute tau in the UV. It's some rational function of nf of nc. And you can again now look at what happens to the IR. You can look at the origin, which is confines without chiral symmetry breaking. It contains nc plus 1 squared mesons and 2nc plus 1 baryons. You can then compute R for the mesons and baryons and the corresponding U, and you can see what tau IR is. It's, again, a free field theory computation. It's some rational function of NC. And it's true that this rational function of NC is bigger than this rational function of NC, so tau UV is bigger than tau IR. So these are very non-trivial statements because these involve theories which have lots of accidental symmetries which act on all these different free fields. So in particular, an interesting point is that you can see that the fully conserved current two-point functions in this phase have an increasing behavior along the RG flow. So if I had picked any random U and considered the two-point function, it wouldn't have a well-defined behavior. But the fact that I chose the U that was picked out by A maximization of the deformed theory gave me a U that had two-point function coefficient that actually had some nice behavior, some regular behavior. Now, you can look at what happens in the confining phase. You can look at what happens for NF equals NC plus 2. Now, here the confining description breaks down, but you can ask a stupid question and suppose that for NF equals NC plus 2, the IR was still confining. And you can ask, what does this tau inequality show? So again, you can compute tau in the UV. You can compute tau for the putative confining phase. And you'll find that, in fact, tau UV is less than this tau for the putative IR confining phase. So the conjecture would be violated. But fortunately, the correct description of the IR is not furnished in terms of these degrees of freedom, but it's rather furnished in terms of the Seiberg dual magnetic mesons and squarks, which have these non-trivial R charge assignments under N, C, N, and F. And you can again compute tau UV and tau IR. Again, it's a free field theory computation. And you find that this rational function of NF and NC in the UV is bigger than this rational function of NF and NC in the IR. So in particular, this inequality, tau UV versus tau IR, tells you it immediately picks out the phase transition from confining variables in the IR to free magnetic ones. But it doesn't precisely predict the onset of the conformal window. That's not a problem, but this inequality holds all the way up to NF is approximately 1.79 NC, which is into the conformal window. It would be nicer, of course, if it broke down exactly at the conformal window. But in any case, it's perfectly consistent. In the conformal window, you can again do some tests. So for example, you can look for NF between 3NC over 2 and 3NC. And again, from the fact that the conformal window is assumed to have no accidental symmetries, it follows from unitarity, what I described before, that tau UV has to be bigger than tau IR. You can still do some more complicated tests in the conformal window. So you can imagine starting from some interacting fixed point in the conformal window, turning on a relevant deformation, and computing, again, these two-point functions. So this relevant deformation is the conformal analog of a mass term. It's dimension less than 2 at the conformal fixed point. And this index A is summed over from 1 to K. If K is small enough, then the theory flows to another fixed point in the conformal window, and the theory trivially satisfies tau UV is bigger than tau IR. If K is larger, then you've integrated out enough matter to flow to a free theory in the IR, and you can compare tau in the UV. This is, in general, a strongly coupled expression, which you compute via Tuft anomaly matching. And in the IR, you have this expression here, which you compute in the free theory. And it's true that this rational function of three variables is bigger than this rational function of three variables. And so tau UV is bigger than tau IR. And you can also verify this when you go down to the confining phase. I'll skip over the discussion of what happens in flows with Higgsing. But you can also consider flows with Higgsing starting from the interacting fixed point or the UV fixed point. And you find that, again, tau UV is bigger than tau IR. And it's easy to generalize this discussion to arbitrary gauge groups, SONC, SPNC. SONC is interesting because it's closely related to N equals 2 theories. There are massless dions and monopoles. And you can again check that tau UV is bigger than tau IR in all these theories. So there are also some more exotic S confining theories that you can check. There are CFTs with accidental symmetries, the so-called ADE theories of interligator and Wecht. You can also check N equals 2 super Yang-Mills, the vacua where massless monopoles and dions exist. And you can find that these are all consistent with tau UV being greater than tau IR. You can also check a variety of other theories, the Kutasov and Brody theories, but I won't discuss these here. So the last thing that I want to talk about is the IR phase of the interligator Seiberg and Schenker theory. So this is a theory which was SU2, an SU2 gauge theory with a single chiral superfield Q in the ISO spin 3 halves representation. So the spin 3 halves representation of this SU2 gauge group. So The question is, what happens to the theory at the origin of the moduli space? So at the origin of the moduli space, classically, there's an orbifold singularity. And the question is, what happens quantum mechanically? So what these guys conjectured is that the theory confines. So they considered quanta, confining quanta built out of the q to the fourth fields. So these guys are gauge invariant chiral operators. And what they showed is that the R anomalies, the U1R and U1R cubed anomalies, matched between the UV theory of quarks and gluons and the IR theory of confined composites. Okay, so they took this to be some non-trivial indication that the theory flowed from a free fixed point in the UV to a confining one in the IR. And if that was correct, then they found that you could deform the theory by superpotential for this field U and find a very simple model of dynamical Suzy breaking. So subsequently, some other techniques have pointed to the opposite conclusion, namely that the IR is interacting conformal. But none of these techniques are quite conclusive for a variety of reasons. But the criterion that I've discussed with you before may be used to prove this, because you can just check very simply that the U charge of Q in the UV is just minus a tenth. You can check the U charge for the putative confining description, this guy U, it's 13 fifths. And so you can check that tau in the UV, in fact, would be much smaller than tau in the IR. So this would conflict with our conjecture. So what this suggests is that this is an example of a misleading anomaly matching. So in particular, it formalizes the intuition that the theory should be too weakly coupled to produce confined degrees of freedom, because basically it's an asymptotically free theory. There's a small one-loop beta function. So you'd imagine that it ends up in some Banks-Zaks phase. Now, there are some better understood examples of misleading anomaly matchings that were studied by Brody, Chon, and Trilligator. So there you have some traceless symmetric tensors of SON and some very complicated putative confining description, which again matches the U1R anomalies in the UV and the IR. But this was shown to be an example of a misleading anomaly matching. So it was shown that the IR phase consisting of these confined composites was in fact not the correct description, because there were some deformations that you could make in the theory to show that this was true. So what Intrilligator and these guys showed is that actually the IR had to consist of a superconformal sector plus a smaller confining sector. And you can check what happens to tau in these two theories. So you can again check for the misleading anomaly matching where you assume that the IR of that theory is confining. You can check that that would violate the conjecture. But then you can look at the solution that Intrilligator and others proposed, which is that it in fact has an interacting sector as well. And you can check that tau in that theory in fact is decreasing as is consistent with everything else. Okay? So it seems to be the case that this theory actually is probably interacting conformal in the IR. I should also say that it's not scale invariant, but non-conformal in the IR, because this is an example of an SQCD-like theory. It's a theory that starts from some free theory, and you turn on just a gauge coupling. Okay, so the conclusion, so what we've seen is that you have some simple multiplets, these R and U multiplets that seem to contain a great deal of physics. So we can use this pair to learn a lot about operator mappings, accidental symmetries, and probably about IR phases. And the question is if we can extend, for example, the duality mapping that I discussed above in the first half of the talk to other non-conserved currents, as in the case with a UV superpotential. And the question for the second half of the talk is, of course, can we prove that tau UV has to be bigger than tau IR? It's also true that you can define a whole spectrum of taus in some theories, which also seem to decrease. So that's an interesting question. The question is, what is the physical interpretation of these different taus? And can one understand sort of the spectrum of taus that decrease in general? So, OK, thank you. Yeah, go for it. Sorry. Let me just go back to A. Yeah, so you can either compute it in a curved background with a trace of the stress tensor, or in these supersymmetric theories, for example, you saw how you computed it, right, from this anomaly functional involving the three-point function and the one-point function of this arc current.
But there's not a similar derivation
for. Yeah, I don't know what the interpretation would be in the curved space, but it has an interpretation in the flat space theory, right, as a coefficient of a two-point function of these U operators.
Yeah, I guess one of the points that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And,
yes.
I'm wondering if maybe this tau is generalized.
So my feeling is that this tau is really only a guy that's defined in R symmetric theories. So even supersymmetric theories, you could ask what happens in supersymmetric theories. First of all, you could be less ambitious, right? And that's what happens in supersymmetric theories without an R symmetry. In that case, the U operator doesn't exist as a local quantity. So in general, it's some non-gauge invariant guy or some, you know, non-local guy. And so making sense of what tau means in that case is already difficult. Without supersymmetry, I don't know how you'd make sense of it, right? The two-point function of the stress tensor gives you something related to C, right, in general.
So
tau is not so actually, this is an important point. So tau actually cannot be any function of A and C. And the reason it's not a well-defined function is because you could imagine starting from some fixed point and turning on different kinds of deformations, right? So just because I give you one fixed point doesn't mean that I have to turn on one particular deformation, relevant deformation, right? In general, there's a family of relevant deformations. And these different relevant deformations, if they preserve different R symmetries, then they correspond to different taus, right? So, you know, for a single theory, there's only one A and one C, but there are many potential taus. So they're not scheme dependent because they depend just on the R symmetry that's preserved along the RG flow, but they're in general non-unique. And in particular, therefore, if there are multiple taus, they can't be a function of A, right?
Yeah, so you're saying
it's completely new information about, sorry? Yeah, you need the so it's some completely different new set of information. Okay, it's so that makes it interesting, but it's also okay, it's also for a more restricted class of theories, right? I mean. So
you mentioned that this is all in 4D.
Yeah.
But I think the axial anomaly in 3D has a very different form.
Yeah, so in 3D you can do the same kind of thing with U. There are some multiplets that you can write down for U in three dimensions, and you can try to construct some guy tau, which may or may not decrease in these theories. I haven't checked, but you can try to run the same story. And I mean, you can try to compute tau UV and tau IR in that case in three dimensions as well. There's no anomaly in three dimensions. Yeah, but you can compute a U. There's still a U which you can compute. I mean, it has probably a different physical interpretation, but there's a U which you can compute. In three dimensions, there's some analog of it. There's an R current, there's an R symmetry in three dimensions, and there's some corresponding guy. And you could try to construct a guy in three dimensions. I haven't worked on that, but I think it's an interesting question. I'm first working on trying to prove something in four dimensions.
Actually, so. If we're going down a dimension, can we go down to two?
I suppose you could. Why not, right? I mean, there's R symmetry there.
Yeah,
so that's a good question. So that's something that I would like to understand exactly what there must be some closer. I still think it's not the same thing as C for the same reason. Right? You can also have multiple relevant deformations in two dimensions. But somehow the story in two dimensions should be very easy to understand.
Maybe the interpretation is simple.
No, that's a good point. Yeah. I just thought about that a little while ago, but yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.